This is Margaret and Eric reporting from somewhere near Seattle, Washington.
The King Oscar Hotel.
The King Oscar Motel. I think, after a very, very interesting day and a big victory for the movement internationally. Today, reporting on Lieutenant Aaron Witada's court-martial. Lieutenant Aaron Witada, of course, is the first commissioned officer to have refused to deploy to Iraq and face court-martial. Facing 4 years in prison. Initially, it was 6 years in prison, but in a pretrial agreement, one of the charges was dropped against Lieutenant Witada. So the jail time he was facing was a maximum of 4 years in prison, and the two charges were
missing
in movement, refusing to deploy, and also behavior unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. We never got a gentleman defined, by the way, in all of this. Yeah. It's a little unclear exactly what that means. The trial went on for 3 days. The first day they established a lot of procedures and also interviewed the panelists, which is in a military court a de facto jury. There were 10 from a pool of panelists, as they started to call them, members. All of them were officers, all we found out of a higher rank than Lieutenant Witada. Out of that pool of 10, 7 jurors were chosen. So the first day, both the government, the prosecution, and the defense, Witada's side, interviewed the jurors. And after that, that pool was narrowed down to 7. The jury included 3 people of color, 1 black man, 2 black women, 1 who looked was lighter skinned, looked like she was of mixed race, perhaps maybe with some Asian in her. And one of the jurors in particular had some religious training, had gone to seminary school and was a psychologist. And interestingly, in the interviews of the jurors, the black woman actually said that she was admired Lieutenant Witada's position. And the judge, after she said it a few times, the judge says, "Oh, you mean surprised by it?" And she said, "Yes, yes, I mean surprised." And then the panelists who have the religious background said that he thought Lieutenant Witada's arguments were interesting from an intellectual point of view. He had never heard this argument before, and he looked forward to actually hearing what Lieutenant Witada had to say.
And many of the jurors, other jurors, said, expressed similarly that they were interested in hearing from Aaron his reasons.
That's right. So that was pretty much a quick summary of the first day. The second day, which was yesterday, the government then presented its case. A very weak case, as it turned out, but there were 3 witnesses that were called. One was supposed to be, was this alleged hotshot expert from, who teaches at West Point, who was an expert on military ethics. But frankly speaking, and then another one was assistant battalion chief, and that was the battalion that Lieutenant Witada was part of. And the other guy was...
He was the battalion commander.
Was the battalion commander. Both of the battalion commanders were the ones that said, well, they were disappointed, and lost respect for Lieutenant Witada when he went out publicly with his refusal to deploy. But clearly, what came out in their testimony is that he had also followed protocol at each step with what he was supposed to do. He did speak with them, they counseled him, he wrote to them, he twice did the formal application for resignation, he was counseled again, he was asked not to quote-unquote make the mistake of a young man, and to think about it, and then to come back and present a five-year plan with how he was going to function in civilian life after having made this decision. Lieutenant Watada did all of that, and at the end of all of that, they denied his resignation application. So it really was not consistent with what they were saying in their testimony and their denial of his application.
And in addition, also the he followed protocol in terms of going to the public affairs office before he spoke out and you know consulted with them ahead of time, spoke out only off base, not in uniform, and I forget there was a third.
The third thing, I don't remember the exact language, but it was basically fundamentally don't be too insulting of you know the commander in chief and the you know your superiors,
right.
So to speak. So the government's and then the government rested its case, which was really a surprise to many of us because the case, frankly, had not yet been made. And then they said they rested the case like they had nothing else. So then today, what was supposed to happen today is that Lieutenant Watada was going to testify in his own name. And I should say that the first day, the judge was very, very combative and basically denied practically everything the defense wanted Lieutenant Watada's side. He denied their right to expert witnesses. And there were some really contentious exchanges with the defense and the judge who really seemed determined to really control what happened in the court and definitely was prejudicial. And was accused of judicial errors and all kinds of things in that first day. By Watada's lawyer, yeah. By the second day, we noted a little difference in the attitude of the judge. He was a bit more nervous. He was more tentative. He really stopped and thought through things and consulted various law books, etc., and also seemed to be looking in the direction of the panelists quite a bit because by then the panelists had been seated. And so the trial had officially begun. Also, yesterday, two of the panelists that also asked questions. One young black woman asked if they were going to have access to see Lieutenant Watada's video because the prosecution had also played the speech that Lieutenant Watada gave at the Veterans for Peace Convention as evidence, and they also played a video of his the press conference, the statement at the press conference announcing that he wasn't going to deploy, and both of those statements were really riveting, and Lieutenant Watada came across as very, very sincere and very committed to the Constitution, etc. And it you know, anybody listening to that speech really had to be quite struck by it. So people thought it was really that the prosecution and its case really was making the case for the defense in both showing the videos but also the witnesses that they had fundamentally, you know, didn't say much of anything besides the fact that they had lost respect for Lieutenant Watada. So what? Big deal.
And that his refusal to deploy had no material effect on morale or on their, you know, on the rest of the troops, except that it generated discussion, and that was about it.
Right. And of course, the government was trying to claim that, you know, for him to, you know, have made this decision, you know, its impact on morale, and one of the battalion commanders was caught in a lie because he was going on about the importance of the bond between an officer and his men, and he knows the nuances of the men, and this is very important when they go into the field, etc., and all of this was, of course, lost and broken with Lieutenant Watada, you know, abandoning his men, basically, and that trust being broken. Come to find out that Lieutenant Watada had actually, they had changed his job. So the bond was broken with the men. He was in with a whole other set of people. So that really came across as disingenuous. And also there were various points where the battalion commander had said, well, he didn't know something. And then he said, well, he didn't quite remember. And, well, actually then he did remember. And, you know, he really didn't come across as being credible in what he was saying. So that was yesterday, and so by the end of yesterday, day two, it was clear that the government fundamentally didn't have a case. Or at least if they had one, they certainly didn't prove it or show it to anybody. Today, there was a lot of excitement. A lot more of the supporters were actually trying to get in because they're limited to 42 supporters per day. And then, you know, there's a whole media circus going on with the media coordinator of the Army. And they had access to getting into the courtroom, and everybody else was in a spillover room where you could only see a screen, the proceedings on a screen. And most of the time, you only saw the judge. You really couldn't see what else was going on in the courtroom. Nevertheless, it was a lot of excitement. Early this morning, people came to get their passes because Lieutenant Watada was going to take the stand in his own defense. We got there and realized that something was wrong because first the judge kind of poked his head in and said, oh, we're going to be half hour late. Okay, that had never happened before. We waited, and the judge came back and said, oh, another half hour. And everybody waited, and the judge seemed to be running around frantically. Meanwhile, the prosecution lawyers, the government lawyers, didn't seem to be running around frantically. They were sort of, everybody was just kind of waiting around for what was happening with the judge. Then another, and this went on for about an hour and 45 minutes. An hour and 45 minutes, we finally start. And at which point, the judge starts saying that he is going to reopen the, what is it called?
Stipulation
the stipulation of fact.
Of fact.
What is the stipulation of fact? The stipulation of fact turns out to be the pretrial agreement that had been agreed and signed by all parties concerned, and it was on the basis of this pretrial agreement that the other charges against Lieutenant Watada had been dropped. And the judge came in very combative, saying that he intended to reopen the stipulation, that there were inconsistencies in what was in the stipulation, the elements in the stipulation, and what was in the notes that the defense had given as the charge to the jury. In other words, what the kinds of questions the defense intended for Lieutenant Watada to address in his testimony. So the judge was saying that there was a discrepancy with what was in those notes that he got from the defense and what was in the stipulation, and that it had to be resolved because everybody had to have the same understanding of the stipulation. The government lawyers did seem to know what the judge was going on about. The judge was getting increasingly impatient that the government lawyers didn't understand what was going on. It was a little unclear whether the defense actually understood what was going on because he kept going on about these elements. The defense lawyer Seitz objected and said that the judge can't just go willy-nilly asking, you know, Lieutenant Watada any questions that he pleased, that this was out of order for the judicial to do, and it was showing prejudice, and what would happen if he advised his client not to answer the questions. And the judge said, well, if you advise your client not to answer these questions, I will declare a mistrial. So then Seitz then said, well, we're going to need some time to consult with my client. And when we return, we will give her an answer as to whether or not Lieutenant Watada will answer the questions the judge wants to ask him about this stipulation agreement. So we broke, and when we came back from that break, which was also after lunch, it was announced that Lieutenant Watada indeed would answer the questions from the judge. So the judge proceeded to question Lieutenant Watada, and then you really got more of a sense of what he was all on about, because the judge's basic case is that Lieutenant Watada, in the stipulation agreement, which said that he refused to deploy, was in fact being criminally, that it was intentionally criminal for, you know, that it was intentionally criminal, and that basically this is what Lieutenant Watada, this was what was in the stipulation.
It was like a guilty plea.
Like a guilty plea. And the government, of course, was agreeing with that. And Lieutenant Watada's position, and the judge asked the question about four times, and each time Lieutenant Watada's position was, no, that my intention, this was not criminal intent on my part, but I did refuse to deploy so that I would not be in a position of serving in an illegal and immoral war, right? So therefore, it was not a criminal act. So the judge was just totally exasperated because I think they thought they had really had Lieutenant Watada, you know, and that he was just going to have to plead guilty to, you know, this particular charge. And the sites made clear, Lieutenant Watada made clear, that no such thing was going to happen. That their understanding of the stipulation, and maybe there was a disagreement with the government about the understanding of the stipulation, but it, from the beginning, that Lieutenant Watada has made the case consistently that he did not do a criminal act. He refused to deploy so he would not have been in a position of fighting an illegal and immoral war and committing war crimes.
Yes.
So that went back and forth. The judge was trying to get the government to basically discredit what Watada was saying and make the whole thing possible, but they seemed incapable of doing so, and the government lawyer was very, very flustered and couldn't make the case. The judge gave him as many hints as he could, referring to a Ferguson case and a precedent, and isn't it this and isn't it that, and the government lawyers still weren't getting it and asked for another recess. And the judge, by that point, was a bit exasperated and said, after this recess, you come back. Here are your options. Either this is going to be a mistrial, or you could reopen your case, keeping in mind the government had already closed their case. You could reopen your case. I know this is a difficult position, a decision, and that all of the witnesses that you would have hoped to have for these other charges. Oh, the other thing that is important, the judge said he would also be, that the stipulation was going to be thrown out. Basically, so the agreement was thrown out, the pretrial agreement was thrown out, because there was no collective understanding of the interpretation of that stipulation. So we took break again, we came...
Could I add also that, well, it seemed like the judge was alone in thinking there was a disagreement. In fact, the government and the defense thought there was an agreement.
Right, and the defense kept saying, well, you know, we don't have any problem, you know, we all signed the stipulation, and we're not challenging the stipulation, because the judge will also seem to be wanting to encourage the defense to challenge the stipulation, which we didn't understand until a little bit later. So when they came back in, and the government and the judge basically asked the government, well, what are you going to do? You want to reopen the trial? Are you going to go for a mistrial? The government lawyer just looked throughout this whole thing. He looked like if he could just crawl away somewhere. He looked very upset. His ears were red. We could only see the back of his head. He was flustered. He didn't know what to do. And when the judge asked this question, he just sort of held his head in his hands, and then he stood up and he said, the government requests a mistrial. Then Seitz objected and said, I object to this call for a mistrial. And then the judge said, well, I am ruling for a mistrial. And then they got into setting the date, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody expected this. I mean, this is high drama going on all day. Lieutenant Watada never got to testify. The panelists, the quote-unquote jurors or panelists, were sequestered in a room all this time. They don't know what's going on. They're waiting all day, only to be called in and told that they were dismissed. They're thanked for your services, but it's over, and furthermore, you can't discuss any of this with anybody unless ordered by a judge to do so. So the judge is proposing March 19th as a new trial date, but clearly that will be negotiated because the Seitz has some conflicts with other trials that he's doing. at the press conference that Seitz held following all of this high drama, he basically said that there is something called a, what is it, clause, where if a case is tried or...
Jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. That somebody said, well, can double jeopardy really apply here? What double jeopardy is that if a case has already been tried and the prosecution has rested, you can't really try the person again for the same crime. And what Seitz said is that, yes, double jeopardy would apply in this instance because the reason for the mistrial was the fault of the government, not the fault of the
defense,
and that it was the government that requested the mistrial, not the defense requesting the mistrial. So the moment a new trial is set, that they're going to move to just have the whole thing dismissed, and that they were very hopeful about this, and that, you know, there are all kinds of instances that they could give to all of the mistakes and errors and prejudice of the judge, and he had no business reopening the stipulation. You know, all kinds of mistakes, basically, that were made that fundamentally they didn't think that there was a very good chance that this case could possibly move forward in any way, and that they would fundamentally have to drop the charges. But of course, all of this remains to be seen, and all of the supporters are seeing this as a victory for Lieutenant Watada and a victory for the movement. Lieutenant Watada himself, his mother, Carolyn Ho, they're very measured in their response, saying that they're hopeful given what the lawyers said, but clearly there's still the specter of a new trial happening. That we'll tell her, and then that's it. I'm calling American Airlines.
Yep.
Right. Okay. We just, so that's pretty much the story. And we just got a call from Carolyn, who has said that the lawyers agree that there is a case law that sets precedent for this kind of discontinuance or retrial. In other words, and both the lawyers, both the Lieutenant Watada's military lawyer, he had a military lawyer, Kim, who seemed quite good and competent, are saying the same thing, that they really can't try the case, that they might try to move it forward, but that they really, you know, there's precedent that really can't, they really won't get anywhere with that. So that was, you know, very good news for Carolyn. I think she felt a bit more reassured, you know, because it sounded, you know, a bit more definite, that, and that is likely why the government's lawyer looked so terribly devastated at the end of the whole thing. So, there you have it.
Yep.
Another battle in Seattle.
That's right.
Ending in a great victory.
Yes.
Anything we should add? We're hungry and tired.
Yes, just briefly, that I was in the spillover room, now not in the actual courtroom, which is very small, as Margaret said. The reaction of people afterwards was a bit like everyone was kind of in shock. I think they didn't, there was a lot of legal terminology that everyone needed to, that no one really quite understood what was going on. When it ended up being a mistrial, people, you know, were really struck by the gravity of the situation, I think. At the same time, I think everyone was, expecting some final decision or something, that it wouldn't have gone on. But you know, people were obviously really happy, especially after the press conference, I think. There was a number of soldiers in the spillover room, military police, that I looked at their faces after the verdict, and there was a number of them that were really grinning from ear to ear about it, and there's a general kind of sense among the guards and stuff that you could just tell they were really relaxed and kind of, you know, happy.
Right. Yeah. That it seemed that way in the other room as well. I mean, they didn't look upset or devastated in any way.
Yeah.
So, not quite sure if this is the report that you wanted, but it's the report you got. So, we'll just have to fill in on another time, and also we will send on the notes, that the rough notes that I took on the computer today.